Hi, everyone. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. I represent the political center and have on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, good to be with you and nice to have a ceasefire.
Yeah.
At least for a few weeks.
Or a few hours here.
Yeah.
And on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello. And hey, listeners. Hope you're hanging in okay.
All right. I want to start the show by just, I want to go up higher, 40,000 feet, and look down at what we're dealing with here.
Well,
how does that sound?
Let's just go to 80,000 feet.
We could go higher.
Maybe we should go to the moon.
I have this difficult assignment sometimes of speaking on the Utah economy, and all of a sudden you can't do anything when you're talking about economic activity but talk about this war.
Yeah.
Because it has so many economic ramifications. And so when I say let's get up, you know, higher up, there was a time when we talked about a peace dividend.
Mm.
You know, the Berlin
90s.
Wall had come down,
yeah.
And all this money that was going into national defense was able to go into productive things in the economy. And I see world military spending. I mean, we're going to have rearmament. We used to have disarmament. We're going to have rearmament.
Yep, yep.
And instability.
Which is costly.
Yeah, instability, uncertainty. How about fragmentation?
Oh, go on.
Well, just, you know, you're all separate actors.
Right.
There's not a world order now where there's sort of a group of countries that are all thinking alike.
Yeah.
We're dividing. And I think that's really troubling for the economic outlook. Comments. John, Shireen?
Yeah, I mean, that resonates with me, I think, about the ways in which the Trump ideology or MAGA in general has created an unbelievable division within our own country, one that feels really hard to reconcile. I feel like I mentioned this recently, but just looking at folks who identify as MAGA, how they continue to say they support Donald Trump, but when you ask them about the specific actions he's taken, whether it's, you know, wars of choice or the tariffs, you know, the increase in gas prices, they don't like any of that. So the reconciliation that folks have is feels really like an immense cognitive dissonance that is only replicating and exacerbated on the national stage. I think we've lost the thread.
John, big picture, and then we can go to some more details.
You were describing that, and I had flashbacks of Stephen Covey talking about dependence, independence and interdependence. And you think about a young child heavily dependent on their parents. And then you get to be those teenage years and you want nothing but independence. Leave me alone. And then you mature and you start to understand how to have interdependence. And we seem to be losing that notion.
Yeah. I mean, globalization is in peril.
Oh, yeah. It used to be in vogue and now it's in peril. Absolutely.
Yeah. So the combination of war, tariffs, inflation, tight immigration policies, the impacts on consumers. I don't know how an economy gets through this without a downturn.
When you say tight immigration, I heard something Stephen Miller talking about deporting 100 million people from the United States. 100 million. That's a massive amount.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, if you're a white Christian nationalist, that's what you're trying to do. I mean, Stephen Miller's impact, long-term impact on the economy of this nation going forward, I think is going to be a travesty, aside from the moral failures and just absolute rage I have towards what he's promoting out of the White House.
Well, so in economic parlance, it's either a growth slowdown or a recession.
Growth slowdown.
That will still grow because recession means you're contracting.
Right.
You're
right.
Getting smaller.
One of the key things.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple of things as I'm looking at the war and so forth. I mean, we've talked in the past about supply chain risks that we have for the U.S., especially when it comes to building up defense capabilities. I mean, on the news recently, there was a news episode about shipbuilding capabilities and how we're a pittance of what it used to be versus Korea and China.
Mm.
Korea being the second largest producer, and they're in the shadows of China by a long way. So you look at those, you look at Iran that has now been empowered to understand the power they have over the Straits of Hormuz and, gee, how they can control the world's economy right there.
Wasn't that stunning?
And waking up
and
to...
And it's not done yet.
No.
There's more straits. There's more choke points.
Right.
I think that a reasonable scenario, let's talk about scenarios, is that this escalates before it de-escalates.
Yeah.
Even with the announced ceasefire, because it looks like it's tattered. You want me to give you some scenarios?
Sure.
Okay. U.S. blinks first. If U.S. blinks first, this takes less time, less duration, and we get back to business. So you could actually...
And what
do you mean by get back to business?
Well, what do you mean
doesn't
by
that mean you have an emboldened Iran?
Stopping.
Yeah. Leaving before you get all of your, you know, said goals, however, you know, many there are. You could also think
But does that mean Israel will back down too, or will we back down and Israel will continue?
So the notion of all these multiple players makes it even
more complicated.
You could also think of Iran blinking first, in which case I think that's a great scenario. I just don't see him doing it. When I saw them lining their bridges with families and children and Iranian flags, what a brilliant thing to do. Can you imagine being the fighter pilot that's going to blow that bridge up?
Well,
did you see the images of that, John?
Yeah, I saw circle around some power plants and stuff like that. Yeah. And one of the questions I have is, to what extent is that forced by the regime? And to what extent is that people voluntarily saying, you're not going to bomb our civilization into oblivion?
So the moral dilemma, if it is forced by the regime, do you still pull that lever?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is
civilian infrastructure and children.
I wouldn't put it past this administration, but it is horrific.
This administration would say, in the scenario you just described, it's joint use infrastructure, civilian and military joint use, and that the regime is using individuals as human shields.
Mm-hmm. And so they press forward. So,
yeah. I think, well, continue, but I have to say, go ahead.
Well, my last scenario, I've got it in my notes here, is Iran regime failure, which could go a few different ways. If the failure is that they are sort of a moderate authoritarian, that's like in Venezuela, that can work in the U.S.'s favor. If there's regime failure that is a democratic turn, that's like Romania.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
But there's two scenarios, a hardline takeover or civil war and anarchy.
Yeah.
I mean, these are really tough questions. I just can't imagine being a reasonable person with high moral leadership trying to navigate this right now for our country.
Yeah.
Throw in the fact that you can look and say this is 47 years in the making, or this is, you know, even decades longer than that, depending how far back in history you want to go.
Or you can look at, I mean, I truly hope that people have the opportunity to go read the recent reporting. So we're recording on Wednesday. It came out last night from the New York Times about how I don't know that there's another way to read the way that we were bamboozled into this by Netanyahu, who showed up and said, well, we really have to do this. This is the time to do this. Trump gets convinced this is a good idea by Netanyahu and is surrounded by sycophants who simply will not say, we don't think this is a good idea.
And apparently Netanyahu was actually in the Situation Room as these briefings occurred.
Correct.
That's a little unnerving to me. I mean, this is our national security.
Yes.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, there's times when you invite your partners in and there's times where
heard of that.
No.
But maybe. I don't know.
I just think that this,
not there. I mean, I can imagine inviting them in a whole bunch of places, but in the White House, next to the Oval Office, I've seen that room. I mean, I don't think of putting outsiders in that room. Maybe I'm naive.
Yeah. I think, I don't know. Anyway, this is at the root of this for me is a total lack of focus on what this means for the Iranian people, which is continued chaos, greater loss of infrastructure, more difficult lives, more lives lost. Like, I just, the whole specter of what is happening here is a direct result of the fact that we have a fully incompetent president who is absolutely unable to do his job.
And on the right, you have two factions, largely, if you will. You've got the faction which thinks he's brilliant, he's a genius. His unpredictability allows him to keep people off balance and drive a better outcome. And then you have the others that you look at the tweet, for example, on Easter Sunday, just going, he's unhinged, he's lost it, he's promised no new wars, he's dragging us into another war, and can't wrap their heads around what this means.
Mm.
Now, I will look, and I'll point out to so many folks, starting on Sunday, really were calling out the 25th Amendment and for J.D. Vance to replace the president, and I think it's foolish to think that the cabinet is going to somehow do that when you don't have even a handful of folks in Congress that will step up and place limits on the president.
The midterms may take care of that.
Yeah, maybe.
Honestly,
yeah.
Who knows? But here's the thing. Moral leadership really matters. And Shireen, when I was calling upon moral leadership, I was thinking of the other people in the administration that could help, even our Congress, right?
Yeah.
And even U.S. governors, business
leaders. honestly, who in Congress?
Well, I respect
these
people.
This is like do nothing, and they've been do nothing forever.
When you have a president saying a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again, when you have a president talking about bombing people to the Stone Ages, when you have a president that's using the F word in public statements, I get really, you know, frustrated with that.
Yeah, I think Mike Lee used to care about things like this.
Mm. Okay,
well, and you're comparing it back to Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Where he had a certain, I think he was viewed as also unpredictable in where he was going and what he was willing to do when you think about Star Wars and so forth. And yet, there was a certain demeanor about his approach that I think you're also hearkening back to.
I feel like it's hard for me to hear this as anything other than shining a turd. I mean, I feel like what is
happening? Shining
a what? A turd! We have a president who is incompetent. We have a president who is absolutely unfit to lead this country. So yeah, we don't like how he talks. We don't like how he acts. There is no logic. I just don't understand how at this point we can continue to find ways to critique the language that's used or the approach. There's no coherent leadership coming out of this administration. This is a grift. He will continue to, I think, financially benefit from this chaos. And I just don't understand. I'm really with you kind of back on this point about what on earth, how on earth do Republicans go to bed each night and sleep with the knowledge that they are letting this continue?
Because we look back at the Democrats with Joe Biden.
We
knew that he mentally wasn't even there, and yet the Democrats.
And did he drag us into these wars? Did he throw gas prices through the roof?
This is a president that was still leading our country when he was incompetent, and the Democrats were excusing it until after he was out of office, and then starting to rationalize why it was okay for them to do that. I mean,
it's just not the same.
John, they talk
they're
a lot.
Both,
well, John
both
and
concerning.
Shereen, they talk a lot about defying gravity, and political gravity is, you know, Trump's defied that for years, most of his career.
Yeah, yeah.
Economic gravity, most people think that's different. I got the state jobs report this morning. 0.6% job growth in Utah. 0.6%. Our historical average is about 3%. Last year we grew at about, you know, we've had a slowdown, but last year we grew at about 1.6%. Wow. Get ready. Because when you have slower job growth, when you have less opportunity, when you have rising unemployment.
And rising costs.
Rising costs. That causes angst, anxiety, disruption, and things start to change.
Oh, yeah.
So could be interesting. Well, let's take a short break, but I do want to talk about Mike Lee and the Attorney General's office. So let's do that in the second segment.
Sounds good.
Natalie Gochner with Shereen Gourbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on UPR. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. That's BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Shereen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. We had quite a jarring in that first segment about what's going on in Iran. I do want to ask you guys one more question about it. What are you worried about next? Because in my mind, what I'm worried about is an escalation that pulls Saudi Arabia into this in a big way. And I'm squarely focused on their desalination plants. I pulled up a map the other day of all of those plants. They get, I don't remember what it is, it's like 90% of their water from the ocean in these plants. And then there's pipelines that bring it into Riyadh. It's not hard to think of how you might disrupt that water. And you know, we're already seeing bombing of their energy infrastructure. So what do you do? What do you guys think next?
Yeah. I mean,
I don't think the ceasefire holds.
No, I don't think the ceasefire holds.
And I think this gets more complicated before it gets better.
Yeah.
I think it's very concerning if we end up with boots on the ground. And I think we're going to start seeing some cyber attacks in the U.S. that we're not used to dealing with.
Mm-hmm. So cyber attacks for you. I'm worried about more, you know, countries getting involved in a more serious way.
Yeah. I mean, I guess classic liberal whatever stuff. I just continue to think about the incredible fallout that this will have for the populations of these countries that in no way, you know, invited this war. Mm-hmm. From Lebanon to, you know, Saudi Arabia, to think about the power disruptions in the region, to think about, I don't see Israel interested in stopping? So where, you know, how do they continue to just the entire destabilization of the Middle East feels like it's only increasing.
In economics, we often teach about sunk costs. It's this idea that sometimes things you can't remedy and move on from them. Don't stay there longer. And there might be some wisdom in stopping and getting out of there, even without getting our... Now, that's a radical point of view from my perspective, but I just see so many interconnections and cascading unintended consequences that I'm super worried about it.
Yeah.
But isn't that kind of what we've somewhat been doing for the last many decades?
And it served us pretty darn well. We've had a peaceful society. We've had some problems, but we've had a great economy. We've done pretty well. And I'd side on diplomacy.
But the Middle East has been a problem. But we got all through that,
and Abraham Accords at UAE, and that's the direction we want to head in and get an Abraham Accords with Saudi Arabia.
I mean,
and
we had the JCPOA before this president threw it out.
I mean, there's diplomacy can do some things, and I think it's better than this.
Well, but we've had proxies going on, all Iran feeding the proxies and the proxies doing their bidding to attack the U.S. and others in the region.
So go at it on the open seas, you know, but it doesn't mean that we're going to stop. It just means that we're not going to be putting boots on the ground, and we're not going to be bombing civilian infrastructure, and we're not going to escalate this. We're going to try to calm it.
So contain and not end is kind of what I'm hearing.
Yeah, but my contain is actually withdraw a bit. Who knows?
Yeah.
Okay, Mike Lee. He's being talked about for the attorney general spot, the Pam Bondi spot. I think this would be a great appointment for him.
Oh, wow.
And okay. I think it'd be good for Utah.
Really? No, I think it would be bad for the American people because I think what's so difficult about what is happening with the attorney general is that Pam Bondi was supposed to, the attorney general's office is not the president's office. It's supposed to serve the people. She was doing her best to serve the bidding of this president. And I don't think that we should anticipate that Mike Lee would do anything different. Let's all remember when he texted the president after the sort of fallout of the 2020 election, just tell me what to say. I don't see Mike Lee as an independent thinker when it comes to leading the attorney general's office for the United States. I see him interested in serving our president.
Okay. What do you say for people that would like to see a change in the Utah U.S. Senate seat?
We can do that.
Yeah. How does it work, John? If Lee was appointed attorney general and confirmed, does the governor pick someone and then does it have to go to the next general election?
Yeah, it goes to a governor appointment. And then I think it's depending on the exact timing of it. Mm-hmm. But in essence, it would be the next general election cycle for statewide offices.
So it could be someone as a U.S. senator for a couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah. Because in essence, Mike Lee is up not this November, but in essence, election would be two years after.
I think that's exciting. The one thing I would say, if the governor gets that chance, make sure you put someone in that role that's not going to run for it.
Oh, interesting.
That's so how I think of it.
Are you saying you'd be open to it?
I would totally be open to it.
a caretaker, if you will. You're in there just to finish out the term.
I just want someone that goes and serves our state, but doesn't use it as a leverage to get reelected because it favors him too much.
Right. Well, and one of the other factors that comes into play, I think it's for Trump, it's the loyalty of this person, but it will also be who does the governor appoint? And I think there were some concerns several years ago. Mike Lee's name was being floated, you know, like Supreme Court, other things like that. But I think a lot of folks said, given the governor at the time, Trump didn't trust who he'd appoint.
Yeah.
And so therefore, that didn't happen for whatever reason.
Any candidates you want to put out there, or is it way too premature?
Oh, way too premature.
I think our Governor Cox would be good in that role.
Let's deal with
some legislators would be good in that role.
Let's deal with our congressional races right now with the...
Yeah. John, there was some other news about this $500 million in Medicaid funds that was supposed to go to patient care. It went to admin fees. This is the work of your successor that's helped bring this to light. Apparently, Beaver Valley Hospital, Gunnison Valley Hospital, uh-huh. Kane County Hospital... These are some of the largest culprits of using this money to support the hospital groups and not get to patient care.
Yeah, and this is one of those concerning things. You have governmental entities in rural Utah that you think are supposed to be focused on patient care, and yet the breadth, most people don't understand the size of some of these organizations and how they've rolled up nursing facilities all throughout the state. And so that is one of those things we started to get a little bit of information right as I was wrapping up my tenure as auditor on some of these issues. And so it's good for auditor candidates to jump in.
So, John, if I understand what you're saying, Medicaid is for people who have struggling socioeconomically, and this is for their health care. And in a lot, large ways, this is seniors. Yeah. I know that Medicare is seniors, but there can be also Medicaid for economically disadvantaged seniors. And
you can think of it as low income.
And how is it not going to their care if it's going to the hospital? In other words, aren't these costs all commingled in some way?
Well, what it goes into is there's certain monies that are set aside for rural America that are higher amounts, disproportionate. Mm-hmm. And so they're leveraging, my understanding is they're leveraging some of the location in rural Utah to pull down extra dollars. And it's feeding, you know, the administrative costs, and a higher percentage is going into administrative costs and not into patient care.
Okay.
Yeah. And patient care supposedly is not just like holding steady and more money going to administration, but patient care is allegedly declining in many of these facilities.
Shereen, anything you want to add here?
I would just add that this is, you know, particularly concerning as a person who it's been a few years, but definitely knocked on doors in Southern Utah in some of these very communities. This is, I think, particular to skilled nursing facilities. So that's especially where you see that confluence of Medicare and Medicaid as people are looking for safe places for their elderly loved ones to be, especially towards end of life or in long-term care. This is, I just would ask Utahns to remember this next time you hear about how we're just one of the best managed states in the nation. And I would just ask, you know, I think that our auditor's office and really having somebody of integrity who's willing to do this work is critically important. If you didn't hear our interview with our auditor, please go back and listen to it. I think it's really important to focus on these roles and understand who you're electing to them.
Okay, we've got some news in the courts. This new, what do you call it? It's a new court, a 3-judge panel. Supposed to help with the trigger law, the abortion trigger ban. Apparently, it's not doing what it's supposed to do, Shereen.
And what do we mean by that?
The legislature created this new court setup to move things along, and in this case, it's being slowed down.
Yes. So I will just say that this, what is so concerning to me about this legislation is it says to me just loud and clear that this legislature and, frankly, our governor, the executive leaders who signed this into law, want to be not just executives. They don't just want to be legislators. They would like to be the courts. They would like to be the juries. They would like to have total control over all branches of government. And I think the independence and the process that we had was working. If it wasn't working fast enough, put more judges in place. Creating an entire another process is not speeding anything up.
Do you not give them, you know, I mean, they're policymakers. They get a set state policy.
Aren't doing that. Over and over and over again, they find ways to extend their power, whether it's the ability to call themselves into session or the way that they want to get into school districts, local government decisions. This is exactly how this legislature acts.
John?
I'm going to say, I mean, we're, what, a month or so into this new court? I mean, it's barely getting rolling. So I think it's a little premature to say it's not delivering on its promise. We have to look at it over many years and see how it does. I think part of the purpose behind it is a 3-panel set of folks to discuss things. It's not just one district court. It's multiple minds vetting these constitutional issues and opining on that. And that's, I think, where the legislature is trying to go.
Yeah. We just finished a LDS Church General Conference. That's a big deal for the church that's headquartered here, Global Faith. They went public, John, with 17.9 million members of the faith. Just to put that in perspective, we think of Utah as a center of the faith, and Utah has, you know, 3.5 million, and maybe about 48% of them, you know,
are LDS.
Self-identify as LDS. So far, far more of the LDS diaspora is out of the state.
Yeah. It's an interesting trend. And I think in conference, you saw a lot of folks with various backgrounds from all around the world speaking, participating, and praying, and singing, et cetera.
So. Yeah. So really quickly, what were the key messages? Key theme?
Peace. Peacemakers.
Love your enemy.
Yeah. Yeah. An important message for this time.
Pray for your enemy.
Right. So, yeah. And a lot of Christ focus and whatnot. Hey, what else do you want to talk about?
Well, I will just say that one of the things that I thought was interesting related to that was the news that while we're seeing a huge number of, you know, a growth nationwide, that what's happening here in the state seems to be moving in a little bit of a different direction. Mm. And whether that's because size of families or just people falling away from the faith, I think it's an interesting trend.
Yeah. Well, and smaller families.
Smaller families. Yeah.
We have a declining fertility rate. So
that's right. What else?
It interesting. Well, how about how beautiful it is right now?
Okay.
I've had visitors coming to Utah, and I'm just so happy to see this state look so nice.
I'll say the same.
Well, let's get a little more rain this weekend, and we'll see how it looks.
All right.
Get it greening up a little bit more.
That's great. That's a wrap. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Natalie Gochner with John Dougal and Shrinker Bonney. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody. Hi, listeners. This is Natalie Gochner. This episode will be available shortly at upr.org and wherever you get your podcast.